writings and works and material on archives. So I'm going to tell you more than that, because let Steve introduce it. So my role will be to kind of chair discussion, and Steve and Vicky and Sue will do some short presentations around this and set up the questions, I think.
Yeah. Okay. I think maybe the first thing I should do is say a couple of more things about the British Artists Film Video Study Collection, which is the project that I'm attached to. There is a little brochure on the case of the back that looks like that, which is probably more information than I need to give at the moment. But essentially what the study collection is a collection of material related to artist film video. So we have copies of artist work on video, film work, video work, video. We have documentation, we have a lot of publications, we have chronological files around events. We have quite a bit of work online. And also a database online specifying the content of the collection. So in terms of people who are interested in this area of work, then we have quite a large collection, an extensive collection. We get a lot of curators, PhD students, writers, programmers, etc., visiting us as resources to research in the area. Where what we're talking about today kind of fits in. I mean, clearly the study collection is an archive of sorts. We've always kind of gone to great pains to point out we're not an archive in the sense that we don't deal with archival material in the same way that film archives do. We don't wear white gloves, we don't use necessary envelopes and all that kind of stuff. It's much more of a kind of hands-on collection. So I've always kind of personally have always made that kind of distinction. Archives and collections and libraries and so on, but I think in recent years that particularly the amount of work that has been digitized and has been available online has kind of blurred that distinction, and I think has the impression on the rest of it is sort of changed the kind of paradigms of what we understand an archive to be. So really what I want to do in this session is to kind of use a couple of, I have a number of questions and a few little demos that we might do later, depending on how the time conversations go. But we've got Vicky Bennett here who works under the name of people like us occasionally, sometimes with who's an artist who uses moving into work from the archive and in many ways returns the work back to the archive. She'll be showing a piece of hers in a minute and talking a little bit about her work. And then Sue Brakel here from the Tate Archives is going to be talking about the relationship of artists to the archives. So we'll get a couple of different positions in those terms, and then I will sort of talk a little bit until I get to yours, and then open up the conversation with everybody else. So first of all, I've already introduced Vicky, but Vicky,
I work with as a collage artist across not just short filmmaking but also making audio work, composition audio, also do a radio show which is also collage work, but generally being a collage artist I'm working with archives of various kinds, both contemporary and from right across when archives were first collected. I'm going to show you a short film just to introduce my work in a moment. I've worked, I guess, from the visual point of view, I've worked with, I don't know, five or six different archives. The one I've worked with the most, which was the initial archive I worked with, was the Internet Archive, which around 2000, I very quickly got in contact with the archivist behind it, Rick Prelinger. He was the first. He's actually the chairman of the Internet Archive. He was the first person to digitalise his work en masse online. And I developed a close working relationship with him, and so in a sense he was the curator of his archive and actually giving me advice as to what I might want to see within his archive. And he gave me his film collection, whatever I wanted, for cost price, which was essential for my being able to make the work in the first place. And that, I guess that's something where I'm coming from. It's always very practical, and aesthetics sort of come secondary, but they're very much a part of what I do. But practically, it's important to be able to access the archive to start with, to work with it. Since then, I've been invited to work with archives. For instance, with the Lux Archive, they invited me to work with their artist film collection and make a short film about that, which is quite an unusual situation to be making art out of art, which is something I've generally avoided, but it's because it's sort of a bit dodgy in a way. But I did do that, and it was put onto their website, so basically publicised their archive, which is also something important, I think, is that through opening up archives, you're publicising them, and it's always, you know, there are many, many ways of publicising content of archives, and I think of archives as being a library, and it seems strange that on one hand a library is open and available to the public, and, you know, anyone can go in, and on the other hand, there's most archives are closed and you can't go in. And it seems strange because they're both libraries that such opposite points of view might come about from the people organising it. Anyway, I'm going to show a short film that I made. I was one of the two artists in residency at the Creative Archive at the BBC 2 years ago. It was a joint venture between the BBC and the Arts Council of England, where we were artists in residence there for 4 months. And we actually stayed a lot longer. Once we went in there, they said, well, actually, you can stay all year if you want. And so we did. They just stopped paying us, and eventually we couldn't get in the door, and that's the point where we didn't go anymore. But I made a short film out of that, and it was a strange situation because it's the archive's got about a million items in it, and so it's a very strange situation to be searching the database of that, because it's not something you can do database alone. You definitely need the archivists within the BBC. And it's very odd because when we arrived, there was nowhere for us to sit. We didn't have our own desk or anything. And they said, oh, it's okay, next week we're making all these archivists redundant, and then you'll have somewhere to sit. Rough situation for them, and for us, we were embarrassed, you know. So anyway, here's a short film I made. I was focusing on, I went in with the idea of finding celebration footage, which in turn I wanted it to be about celebration of the archive, and it's called Trying Things Out.
You have a pattern of mind that can build mental models in your head, almost anything. It's really a very childish situation. There's nothing remarkable about it. After all, little children will sit in a corner of the boiler with some mud and pile it up. He's built a Crusader castle. There's a Crusader castle here. Well, there's one in his head. And my head is full of those sort of images. Actually, realistic, they just come out like that. I have lost that, you see, through not being overtrained, perhaps. So, it doesn't worry me at all, whatever the problem is. I can pick it up and play with it, just as a child might. If I can do it. It's that sort of game I'm playing all the time, I suppose, really.
That there are also a lot of stereotypes about archives and archivists. So lots of
to try and counteract a little, because I think artists haven't always been very good at speaking for themselves and getting involved in these debates. And so really, I guess what I've been looking at over the past sort of 18 months or so is to get involved in the kind of discussions that are happening and try and open up that dialogue between the archivist, the researcher, and the practitioner, which is why I've been so interested to see these events evolving. And so, against that background, so what I've come to do today is just to sort of offer a few thoughts, but then I really want it to be, as Emily's been saying, a conversation, because I think as we move into the digital environment more and more, it's more important than ever that this dialogue happens, and that as archivists we understand what our users want from us, what their expectations are, what their needs are, but also that we explain what our situations, what our limitations may be, but also how we can work together. Because I think that kind of collaboration as well is going to be more important than ever in being able to open up our holdings for use, because after all that's what they're there for. And we do have these sort of twin pillars between which we have to operate, really. One of which is the security of the originals, and I would imagine sort of the preservation sense as well. And obviously that whole thing is changed by the digital environment, which is one of the things that I hope we'll talk about in the discussion after this today. But at the same time, there are still the originals, and we do have to ensure that those are preserved so that future generations can still have access to them. So it's finding that balance between those two things. And it's interesting what Vicky was saying about thinking of archives as the same as a library, because I actually think of them as very, very different things. Although I can understand that to the user, especially in the digital environment, you may want to have access to that material in the same way. But from my point of view, an archive, the difference between an archive and a library is that what's in the library is not unique and doesn't need that same level of preservation and security. Although when you're then talking about surrogates, which can be replicated, you do get into a more grey area, I suppose. I'm also very intrigued about what it is about archives that has become so appealing over the last few years. I think there's something about ourselves in there. I think there's something about the ambiguity of archives, the sort of the unfixedness of them, the fact that you can look at them in so many ways. In that sense, they're sort of, you know, broadly speaking, they're great personal territory, aren't they? Because it isn't about what's said on the document, it's about the circumstances that created it or the perspective from which you're looking at it. And then this idea of the archives as a site of construction, which anybody who's heard me talk before, Hermes constantly referred to this article. There is an article by Hal Foster in October a few years ago where he writes very evocatively about the archive as the use of archives by artists, and that they're sort of revisiting fragments of things that did or didn't happen in the past and using those as a launching off point to try new things out. And so in a way I think of archive holdings as they're sort of one version, well not one version of something, but it's capturing one aspect of things which then people can look at in an infinitely new number of ways, recreate, represent, reiterate. And I think that's the thing that at this moment in time particularly is really exciting about archives. And so I think the role of archivists is evolving in that sense, because the way we might want to capture archives, because for me it's really important to keep the original context of where archive material came from. So to know that the bits of film, for example, that Vicky used were created for a particular purpose by the BBC archive. Now of course that isn't where Vicky's coming from in relation to them, and that's the beauty of it, in the sense that you can have this original version captured and its context created, and then it can go on to have a whole load of other lives. But if somebody does want to come back and find out what that was, that evidence is there about, you know, sort of our shared history or the history of that institution. So it's this whole thing about context and decontext, I guess, you might call it. I think another area of archive practice that is often discussed, and is in a way the bit that is quite uncomfortable for archivists as well, is the whole question of selection. In that archives or collecting do make selections, it's inevitable, because if we keep everything, we'll just sort of drown in this stuff. I think we all, you know, most of us probably have that problem on a small scale at home or in the office, whatever. But we can't keep everything, so we do make selections, and those are inevitably dictated by
the time in which we're operating. So what a 19th century historian or archivist might have thought was important to collect would have reflected a lot of prejudices or, you know, biases at that time. And no matter how much we try and be objective in what we do, we inevitably, obviously, are also subject to that. And I think it's one of the things that people, certainly a lot of things that I've read or heard, people feel quite uncomfortable about in relation to archives, especially when archives are associated with institutions. And I think there's a lot more to be said about that aspect of things as well. And that sort of leads on to the digital environment, because there's that sort of digital utopianism, if you like, idea that everything can go online and everything can be equal and we can keep everything, which is, you know, a really great idea in lots of ways, and there is space to keep all things, but still those things do need to have some kind of selection processes carried out on them, or we won't be able to find anything. And then there are questions about preservation, who will preserve what goes online as well. So I think there's a lot of discussion to be had there about what archives are doing and need to be doing, and what researchers want, and what those sort of two areas can learn from each other. And in terms of just some initial thoughts about what I think the role of the archive might be developing like in that digital environment, I guess as a sort of trusted source, as I say, where the original function and context of the material is captured, which is just one of the infinite potential ways that that material can be presented, used, reiterated, collaged. But the archivist, much more as a sort of facilitator of that, rather than these ideas of sort of gatekeepers and the secret. And it may be that sort of repository facilities for keeping originals will be quite separate from the kind of provisions that will be made for access. And I know I've been having a number of conversations with partners and potential partners in the academic environment about how we can work together to meet both our needs. So in a way, I think the archive's role is to create some bedrock catalogue data about our holdings, because they're so huge, and this is the problem that is often quite hard to get across, that the sheer volume of material means it's not very feasible or affordable for us to digitise everything that we hold. So again, we come back to sort of select questions of selection. But I think our role is to just try and get information about our holdings as much as possible out there, so at least people can find what they need, and then we can sort of build more experimental or, you know, more customised projects on top of that for particular research needs. So that brings me really back to this idea of the archive as a starting point, and opening up that access, really.
Claire mentioned in her introduction that this is the kind of second part of something that started as a study break. I'm not sure what I'm doing here, because I just thought about doing this at about 2 o'clock this morning. So there might be a little bit of quiet or flashing around. But what I thought I might do is just to kind of run quickly over what I did at that study day. Not it was about 45 minutes, so I'm trying to compress it down to about 3 or 4. But this came out of a project that I'm in the process of trying to develop, which will be it's proposed that it will be a project about how artists can actually use archive materials where these are digital archives. And talk very specifically about digital archives and broadly about moving image on digital archives, although it's not exclusive, that's kind of the main focus given our kind of area of work in my career interests. When we started developing this project, it was based on an equipment resource which is still kind of in its kind of formative stages in a way. But one of the things that was proposed that we might be able to do was have some kind of multi-screen setup, which on one hand would link to exhibitions, curation, perhaps performance, and that kind of thing, but also at the sort of the back end, as it were, could also be a link to a number of, let's say, moving image archives. I mean, I've been thinking particularly locally about the work in the study collection. So what I did at our first study day was a kind of three-story building. Well, it's three separate buildings being built simultaneously. On the left is primary contrasting elements by Minero Yamaguchi. In the middle is Link by Derek Boucher, and on the right is John Latham's Speed. In many ways, they're quite different artists, although they're all moving in each work, so they're quite different artists and quite different orientations. But what I was suggesting with this is that they're all concerned with pattern. I mean, a lot of them are based very much on the disc or the circle. So I was interested in the potential. These are even more diverse. We've got Minero Yamaguchi again on the left. In the middle is Euro Techno by Stanford, which is a kind of rave produced, generated via 1988. And on the right is Dot Cycles by Guy Sherwin, who is very much a kind of materialist filmmaker and made the film by Archie Bolton and the instrument of the film. And yet there is this kind of, and this is very basic, it's not a terribly sophisticated way of thinking about things, it's kind of not much more than pattern recognition. But my suggestion is that perhaps this kind of way of simultaneously investigating a number of different works at one time will bring up new ways of looking at work. We thought rather kind of speculatively about the possibility of things like image recognition software, rather than, say, keyword tagging and so on, to actually interrogate the context of the image. But really, this was just a way of... So this is the kind of thing that I was presenting as perhaps being possible in terms of methodological research in real time of images, image-based archives and collections, with a kind of multi-screen format. And of course this is the kind of thing that has been made, the potential for this has come out of the fact that these things are kind of digitized. But also I was rather influenced by people like David Warburg and his notion of setting up no-assignee kind of collections of images and doing what sort of characterizes as kind of working with digital clusters, so that's as a way of making kind of new and interesting perhaps connections between works. I was also kind of very interested in something that Patricia Zimmerman he wrote a thing called a manifesto for migratory archive. And part of that manifesto, she said, our private objects are not static but provisional and fluid. They can be mobilized to create a collaborative, performative space for the imagination of new histories, new futures, and new work. So this is this kind of idea of kind of spatialization of the visual experience, the methodology, and the performative nature of this, putting together a number of works and collecting different kind of connections and so on as a way of approaching work. And research into that. In the course of the study day, afterwards it became kind of aware to me, it became apparent to me that there are kind of sort of three particular models that coexist at the moment. And again, I'm talking very much about moving image archives and collections, but also talking about kind of relatively recent practice of editioning, of moving into work and gallery spaces, which and kind of more commercial gallery, and the way that editioning confers a notion of kind of originality and authority. The work is, once again, although it's a DVD and it's an endlessly reproducible kind of mechanical reproduction, anyway, it's been editioned and it has become a unique object. Value on it. So that, in a sense, I kind of identify that as being kind of 19th century model, which is completely contemporary as well. There is also the sort of 20th century model, which one could think of as the kind of the Tonkov type model, which is more about distribution and returning fees, small fees for large run distribution to filmmakers and so on, which is much more about a kind of collectivist economy. And then there is the sort of what we might call the 21st century model, which is the online internet archive, Google web, Creative Commons type approach to the distribution, which is much more of a kind of creative economy. So it did occur to me that there were all these models coexist at one time. I mean, although I kind of assigned them to different historical periods in terms of their kind of provenance, they are as important in terms of their existence right now. So, I mean, in a sense, what this did, and I'm just kind of speculating out loud here, I'm not really making any points at the moment, is this hopefully going to be a kind of spur of a conversation rather than anything else. I mean, I was kind of thinking, well, we're thinking about the archive as a kind of a meta archive, as the idea of the archive is this conceptual archive. One or other of these things, and also the notion of the archive as a process or as an interface, as much as anything. Then on Wednesday night, I saw a few people. I was kind of thinking about how we might sort of frame things in the conversation here about archives, and particularly about and what the implication of that is for, I mean, from my point of view, particularly kind of practical place of search, but also from the point of view of collection, digitization, and division. And I went to see a band called Taps at the project of New Cross, and they were absolutely astonishing. I mean, they've been around since, a lot of people know about them, they've been around since the 70s, and there are kind of two surviving members of the band. But they played the most astonishing gig I've been to for certainly this year. And at the end, one of the members of the band, they had a chainsaw on stage, and they had a cement mixer, and they had big bits of metal that they were banging, and all this kind of, shirts and noise up and stuff that they did first, and at the end, the whole audience was showered with wood chips from some kind of chainsaw collection machine, the guy with the chainsaw, and it was like, I was standing there in this kind of snowfall of wood chip, and it landed on my head and my shoulders, and when I got home, but I was standing there thinking to myself, this, in a sense, what are we going to be losing in terms of the relationship with material objects when we come to the digitization, particularly kind of moving into material? And I was standing there thinking, I'm but the digitization is not immediate, and it's a process. So I almost came around to thinking that, well, actually, is this such a good idea, but more a question of what is it that we're going to be losing, in terms, particularly in terms of practice-based research, in terms of our relationship with material and the materiality of particularly moving image. I mean, I was thinking of, I might just play something like this. But I mean, I was thinking, as an artist myself, I'm very, I think that materiality and media specificity is incredibly important. And these are the things that, that already have been blurred by digitization. But for example, this film here, a little bit on here, which people might be familiar with, Michael Arnold.
Relationship to the archive. So can we just put those, let's just kind of have a bit of a free freeform them, put those on the table and see where we get to. We've got lots of pragmatic possibilities because we keep saying we can collaborate to do all kinds of things. But let's just intellectually stick those out there then. We've also got oral history, we've got sound, we've got using the archives that Hans Kelsen does and is going to do recent work that have been just archived in a number of cardboard boxes, and what do artists do with those? So let's kind of stick those on the table, can we? Or in there. So I'm going to begin, Kathy.
Well, one of the things I'd like to also pose, actually, as much as what we lose is what we get.
Mm.
I mean, we've been sort of working along, we've been thinking along similar lines for some of the material that we've been trying to digitise and develop software tools to reinvestigate from different kinds of perspectives, really. But also, one of the things that we're kind of on the edge of trying to do, and we need help, really, any ideas from anybody, is that some of the material we've got, we don't feel that we have any, we have no authority, you know, we have no authority to speak about it.
Mm-hmm.
It's members, it's material belonging to a collective, mm-hmm. and it's something that we would like to open to members of that collective to comment on, to tag, to add things to do whatever. And actually, we've been trying to sort of think about a way of operating that. So, I mean, what I wanted to say really was that digitisation offers a lot of other opportunities. It offers the opportunity to open up the material, not just for artistic reuse, but also for reinterpretation
mm-hmm.
from
yeah.
all sorts of different perspectives.
No, no, I agree. And it's actually, from, I'm kind of coming from that position that my, you know, my epiphany was being challenged with woodchip. In terms of thinking about materiality, because I mean that's partly what I was doing with the multi-screen piece, was suggesting that there is a lot to be gained from digitalization, and of course, you know, there's a lot to be gained from the idea of putting everything on online. It's, you know, it's available to everybody everywhere, more or less, at any, you know, any time. And also, I was kind of there was a circular that came out from GIST the other day about the new funding stream where you wanted to apply for funding to digitise material, which, you know, in terms of our work at the study collection, I was quite interested in, because we still have quite a lot of funding to digitise some material, but we still have quite a lot of work to do in that direction. But the conditions of this funding were that it would be openly available to everyone, i.e. on the web, that everybody can access it. And that opens a whole can of worms for IP issues and you know, license agreements for us, which is something that we just don't have the resources to.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that's kind of part
mm-hmm.
of that. But it did also kind of introduce that question as well, you know, there is now an expectation that everything is going to be on the web.
Mm-hmm.
If things aren't on the web, they don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
but let's think.
Kind of paradigm.
We're Jeff Laycock.
Yeah, the thing about the sort of the benefits, obviously, of having things in an internet environment is substantial when it comes to access. Obviously, there's a real sort of step away from the actual experiential sort of thing of experiencing a work of art or an artistic performance or so on through the digital environment. But for me, one of the most interesting points, you know, when you're considering the sheer volume of both the information that's in static physical archives that could be digitized and also the digital information, is actually the methodology of discovery.
Mm.
I think discovery is the most interesting sort of conundrum in the web environment that we're having to deal with, because really it's the people, you know, we have to look to ourselves in a sense, as the people who are going to be using and accessing this content and finding ways of making relationships that exist between different types of content to make it sort of findable and discoverable. Because, you know, when you're presented with, you know, with a box full of papers, it takes you days to go through that box to find the one or two things that you find interesting. Potentially, in the internet environment, that problem could be multiplied 1,000, 1,000,000-fold, which in a sense was why, you know, the Google search engine was so successful by accident. incidentally, but this is the concept of the links going through to the different objects, the different websites, prioritise them. But I think what we need to think about as a concept, and maybe this is a potential research outcome or a research project in a sense, is, you know, are there ways of developing sort of the tracking and the voluntary publication of research processes and online discovery processes of researchers and practitioners to try and effectively provide a window into how people will use the internet, and also it will allow you effectively an ontological route through to finding things, a kind of a metaphysical link between things in the internet environment, as opposed to having to rely on the purely physical associations which we're trying to replicate.
I just wanted to bring in the notion, the notion of social engagement. I agree, you know, we gain as much as we lose, because every object that's produced is part of a social engagement. So your epiphany is partly about a deeper kind of social engagement. And there will always be those social engagements, but it's kind of lacking in some kind of thing about constructing them.
I mean, I think there are new kinds of social engagement which are happening in the internet environment as well, aren't there? People are expected to interact with the archive material and to be able to comment on it and leave their own selections. And so, whereas traditionally it's physical archives, you have a hierarchical relationship, sort of one to many within a particular collection. But in the online environment, you get to many to many relationships where actually people can rearrange those holdings in infinite ways based on what their interests are, but that you can always go back to what the original context, and also
the concept of the live archive in that sense, in that, you know, an archive is now, because of the internet sort of revolution, an archive is kind of like it's starting from a point of now, and you're archiving what's happening now as you move on into the future at the same time as trying to retrospectively archive what's happened in the past. Basically that just means it gets really confusing. So navigation, I think, is the key, so you understand where you fit in within that environment.
I think something else that's important is the way that material is digitalized, you know, and perhaps we need a little bit more imagination in the way that material is recorded, because I think, you know, there is a problem that stuff becomes disembodied when it's in an archive. You know, that a painting will be photographed flat on and sharply edged, you know, whereas perhaps an angle shot, you know, or a number of views of an image, you know, perhaps in the case of, you know, taking if an artist's work is being digitalized, maybe a few pieces are actually viewed from a number of different perspectives and things like this. So there is that kind of sense of the physicality that Steve was talking about being retained. Because I think, you know, otherwise everything becomes very, very similar on the web. And despite the fact that you may be provided with, you know, dimensions and materials, once that generally gets forgotten. And what you perceive is, you know, that a Jackson Pollock becomes the same as a Paul Klee, you know, and as if they are at the same, the same thing. So that differentiation can get lost.
So everything becomes information.
I think that's where archives can be interesting as a supplementary thing to sort of official records and art collections, because you could come into an archive and there might be an installation showing that work in an exhibition, or there might be the artist working on it in the studio, and you can build that perspective, that 360 degrees perspective, which is so important.
Yeah.
But it's making sure that that material is accessible to people, and I think that's a real challenge as well that we've sort of touched on already, because if people can't get to it easily, like through the Google search or whatever, then it might as well not be there, because they will just take those first results, and that's a big challenge.
This is why we've always approached things from the perspective of the public first when it comes to recording things in an online environment, because from the perspective of how we designed and built a database, it was more, you know the sort of the flat records of the artworks in themselves were vastly augmented through additional information, images, related documentation, and also the relationship between artists, collaborators, curators, events and locations, so that you can actually start to build up this much more integrated view. I agree with you. Often, so, you know, when you present a collection with the option of putting an installation view of a work up as effectively the cover image within a system like a database, or putting up the flat, you know, edged image, they'll always go for the flat edged image. But when you've got to the point of discovery, when you get in there, it's actually, for me, seeing people interacting with things and understanding video and so on and so forth. There's big moves now from a research perspective towards 3D modelling, for example, of installations, which is a fantastic concept but massively impractical. But it, you know, it's you know, I think that's the way to look at it. I completely agree with you. It's in the round. It's exactly the same as well.
But might there also be kind of intellectual and methodological tools that we can apply around the notions of archives that aren't just to do with, for instance, things like digitisation? So, in other words, how are we thinking about archives? It seems to me that there's something we've already moved away and beyond just the idea of preservation, which is still very, very powerful within our culture at the moment, because we seem to believe history is ending, I think, partly. Therefore, in some, I don't know who it was earlier for, but anyway. But the idea of artist use and reuse seems to me one of the really interesting things we can talk about, and brings in notions of authority and responsibility that Kathy's talking about. And that's a really interesting and difficult area for artists and researchers, I think. Pam, what do you?
Maybe keep a series of questions I haven't actually got the answer.
Can you speak up a little bit, Pam? You're a dead thing.
This is probably going to be, from my point of view, a series of questions that perhaps might hit the nail for somebody, and anyway, some of the issues interesting in my continued work around archives. An archive that I worked recently with was the Stasi archive, which is obviously a very difficult and problematic archive to work with. And you know, one that brings up a lot of ethical issues in some ways, some of the ethical issues. Whether an artist should use an archive of such particular perspective. And I think that issue has been raised by Susan Sontag in relation to photographs that have been taken by Nazi soldiers in places like the Warsaw Ghetto and other sites during the Second World War. I think that is one issue that we might like, that is an interesting area to look at. Now that artists are wanting to work more and more with archives, and I find myself wanting to work with archives. Why would I want to do that? Because I'm interested in reconstructing aspects of history that I haven't got access to, and making kind of, well, as a means of understanding the past in relation to the present, and how that might be possible to make artworks which somehow touch, kind of offer that debate, or put that on the floor for debate. Then there's an actual kind of working with another kind of archive, which I have been doing in Brixton, which is it's the SCRSSO, which is the Society for Cooperation with Russia and the former Soviet Union, and it's an archive was established in 1924 and carries on today, obviously up to 1999 with the collapse of the Soviet Union. It changed its name. But this is an archive which hasn't been digitised. It holds the treasures of theatre, kind of Soviet theatre, and also some film and art, and it has a huge library. And for me, it tells, well, what I'm asking it to do, but I'm kind of doubting whether it can do that, because maybe it's not such a huge archive as I'd imagined.
which is, for instance, actually, my husband's a historian of the book, and he works in archives all the time. And everybody he deals with, and he's quite an unconventional person, but they're all incredibly well trained in archival history. I mean, they know how to get, you know, anything from an archive. We're not particularly. Are there methodological tools, though, that artists are bringing in the use and reuse of archives that are really different, valuable, that begin to generate very different kinds of questions, different possibilities that remake work, which is what Vic was doing, really. Chris Dawley Brown, they went into the BBC as an Arts Council initiative. What kinds of things are we there? Are we doing there? And I should kind of like to draw on Kirsten May, if you're happy to, because when I went to Belfast and talked to Kirsten and Declan about Interface and about the research centre that they're running in Belfast, one of the things that you said to me was that in some ways we live in a kind of archival condition, and your whole approach is a notion of thinking about how that interacts in the present, as well as being something that you've employed an archivist, I think, in the centre straight away. That was part of the bid for your centre, an awareness that this is part of the kind of ideology and informing idea of the times that we live in. I'm sorry to call on you like that, but it's something I've thought about so much since and brought into our discussion.
No, that's right. We have employed a full-time archivist not because we were particularly keen to acquire archives. That's something we're definitely not doing. But we wanted to scrutinize existing and develop new approaches to archiving by looking at the institutional context in which archives exist, obviously issues of power and authority and authorship, but also to consider other resources that have not been recognized within the institutional context of archives. And of course, ethical concerns, as has just raised, are part of that, and have actually, I was going to say forced us, but have motivated us to look at layered and multiple perspectives in order to utilize the available resources and play different pragmatic settings and perspectives up against each other. I mean, my immediate reaction to the Stasi archive would be, well, the Stasi archive goes back 40, 50 years now. There's still a lot of people living, so these resources held in there need to be countered or read against other accounts and history, material culture that exists there, and it's a privilege in some respects compared to other resources that are held where these witnesses are no longer available. So there are a number of strategies, and I think that need to be, or can be worked with an artist, perhaps in a particular way, are in quite an interesting position because of their training in divergent thinking. Mm-hmm. And also, I mean, as much as archival training is a necessity to data mine, mm-hmm. it can also produce blind spots which people from other perspectives may not have. They come with other blind spots. So in a way, we need to work in a multiple dialogue conversations to open up horizons and reveal blind spots to make material productive. Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to raise something about the politics of archives. I mean, I use archives intimately as an artist. You know, I'm so dependent, kind of frightened on my computer now. And so, you know, I use archives intimately. But also because of generation, I've become much more aware of our archives as I get older because of mortality. Mm. But I think we have to be very careful when we're talking about archive because, I mean, it's nice to talk about the digital age. But there are many people who still use material and have not come into using digitization in terms of archiving. And there are a number of issues. One, I think there's a poverty of training within archives, but especially in archiving. I'm talking here, and I work in and of and outside of a sector around black artists. And so there's art, there's archives that artists use, and there's artist archives. And there's also issues around the relationship between the artist and the institution, which raises these questions of power, authority, ownership, authorship, and access. And a case in point would be 2007, which was the abolition of slavery. Lots of archives were accessed, lots of archives were created. In 10 years' time, how is that going to be accessed? Who has access to that? Who controls that? And it is a really crucial issue, because we are in the area, as a writer now, of issues around intellectual property and giving over our moral rights. For instance, when you work with the fellow, you hand over your moral rights. It's gone beyond kind of copyright now. We're in an area of kind of moral rights and intellectual property. And I think there really needs to be some real discussion about the fact that we are still in a very traditional, while we may be in a digital age, we're using very traditional kind of methods of looking at archive. And I'm afraid there is issues around kind of power, there are issues around the institution feels, we're doing it for your benefit, for posterity. Well, whose benefit? What posterity? What happens to an archive when an archive collapses? What then happens with that material? How is it dispersed? I know of a few frightening instances where theatre companies, black theatre companies, innovative theatre companies, have lost their archives for particular museums, and there is no archive expert to catalogue that material. It's been there for 10 years, 15 years, no one can get access to it, yes, because of some legal loophole. In the meantime, people are continuing to kind of replicate those kind of bad models of practice in terms of how what's deposited in an archive, what is the legal framework, who owns it, who has access to it. So while I think I take a point about stereotyping, and I acknowledge that, stereotypes are based on some form of truth.
Yes.
And it's not so much archivists, however, it's about is the institutions which archives work within, and what is their relationship between, and where is the equity there in terms of the artist and the institution?
Yeah. I think the sort of situation you describe is probably quite common, because archives do go into institutions, and there is material which takes time to catalogue. We have material which we don't have catalogued, and we used to make it freely available, even if it wasn't catalogued. But then we had somebody who came in and tampered with the material that we had. And because we had access to things that we didn't have full documentation of, even though we'd been checking before we issued them, you know, this problem arose, and we then had to close access. What we do now is that we say, if people want access to material that isn't catalogued, if they can tell us as specifically as possible what it is they want to see, we'll try and locate material relating to them. But you know, that is still frustrating for people, and you've done that. And then you do have sort of the institutional sort of tensions between, well, I suppose you've got the context then of, yeah, legislation like freedom of information and data protection, which we have to juggle as well. Is there that personal data which we're talking about in relation to the starting on? And then sort of institutional tensions about branches of an institution that might want to make money from commercial activities, and areas of the institution that might be, you know, trying to operate in quite a different way, which is about opening things up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There is a lot to discuss in there.
I would like to say that as an artist, I sometimes, very often, see myself as a collector of violence. By that I mean that my studio is filled with files of cutouts from newspaper articles and video. You know, I take video from the newsreel when I watch the news in the evening, because I'm very interested in politics and what's going on around me in the world every day. So many times most of my works are based on real stories. For that reason, I always look into archives or try to find information about those stories that I first see, let's say, in an article in the newspaper. So that puts me into the the thing into looking into it more closely, and I start a research that can sometimes last for many years. And while I'm doing this, many times I use archival material. Like, for instance, just lately I was working on a video which is based on the story of a 14-year-old girl who was shot in Derry in Northern Ireland in the year of 1975, as she was going to work at home from school. It was by accident, because that day it was what the Northern Irish called, there was troubles, during the troubles. So I became very interested in that particular story of that young girl, and I started researching and collecting material around her, because I wanted to make up, let's say, my own story around her. And in that way, I even got some, I was very lucky because I got insofar to get material from video footage from the television of those days, and they even found her actual death, you know, the minute it was happening. So I used that material, or parts of it, but in my own interpretation, together with my footage that I took in Derry, in order to create my own story. And I do that very often with a lot of my stories. For instance, another story was about women in death row in the United States, which for me is a big, became a big issue. And by looking into it through the internet, and I got access into their emails, some of them. I exchanged ideas with them, and this becomes very real sort of thing. But because I'm not a historian, but I'm an artist really, my work, let's say, it's like documenting something, but in a different way.
That brings us into the issue of, I mean, perhaps things used to be simpler in a sense, but now the responsibilities of having that level of material and the relationship between documentation and interpretation are absolutely, perhaps, mind-blowing in a sense, of which we're kind of going into. And we want surely to find what the intellectual approaches and the creative methodologies might be that enable us to do that. Kirsten, do you want to kind of enter into this?
I wanted to add that, of course, the realization of the role of documentation and archiving of practices has been absolutely crucial to insert, to validate practices, to insert them into the art historical and art theoretical discourse, and to uphold the myth of the artist's genius. And in that respect, against other practices that are collaborative and participative, and from there I think there's a necessity to look into practices of documenting and the way these practices are being supported or hindered by commissioning and funding models, by institutional practices of archiving, dealing with documentation of access, etc. And what role they also play in the commodification of art and culture, because in the end a powerful archive like the Getty Archive or the Tate Archive plays an important role in cementing the value artists have in the market.
But that almost suggests that one could, in a utopian world, set up a set of PhDs and postdocs that, for instance, looked at the role of collaboration, ensemble, and power and ideology. That is that a role that we can take? For instance, are we doing that? That's one of the things, because you're suggesting serious social and cultural research that we can
we have done the policy in the area of community-oriented practices to look at the role policies and funding models play in order to empower or disempower cultural producers of inserting their practices into the discourse and into the rewriting of.
As you're talking, are you also suggesting, it's funny, because as you started to talk, Despin, I began to think about a book that was published in the 70s in Glasgow when they had a big media studies centre called More Bad News. And there was a kind of very, there was a Marxist and, approach to the analysis of media at that point. And I wonder if we're even forgetting, in terms of our own historicising of the archive, do we need to get back into collaboration with that a very powerful social science research that was done, for instance. Are you suggesting, Kirsten, a really expanded field of research in which artists, social researchers, and other activists can work together?
Absolutely.
I think
as much as we need to have disciplinary expertise, and we do need that, I don't want to wipe that away, so I think transdisciplinary dialogue and the setting up of, although the word is overused, interdisciplinary spaces and multidisciplinary approaches, and I'm very much in favor of the differentiation between them, I think help to differentiate and make available more sophisticated approaches and methods to scrutinizing these very complex fields. I don't think that a singular disciplinary expertise and perspective is sufficient enough to tackle that.
So do we then need a different approach when thinking about funding bodies here and problems that we've all had with, for instance, if we're going to suggest that artists work on archives, we put them into the notion of practice-based research. We just had this in an application we've done. Or we have to use artists as consultants, for instance, because we can't bring them into a funding application unless they have a research track record that can be validated, or they're mentored by one of us who has a PhD. And in other words, that's a really complex thing for us to get that theory together.
Can I say something as an artist? One of my dreams would be for, say, an art student to come and do research with my archives.
Mm.
Okay. So this is one way of collaborating with an institution, but at the same time having some sort of power and offering. No, because I very much, I think many of us have talked about the dangers of being over-accessible, because the work can always be interpreted or totally out of its own context. And simply, and this is what was so interesting when you showed your film, that we all knew. I can understand your reaction. Instinctively, we all knew the names of the artists who had produced the original images, but then you used it for to make a completely different point. Perfectly right. They're both perfectly right. But what happens? When say, I'm not allowed, because I knew who John Lennon is, you know, still is, right? So after that, he just becomes a very fast moving image in something which is not relevant to his work specifically, but it's relevant to a point of research, okay, your people say. So it all becomes suddenly very complicated. And this is where we somehow, I think it is needed to have a kind of methodology that offers the information necessary so that people, it's not a matter of, I'm trying to find the right word, it's not respectability, definitely not, but it's near that
propriety, something like
it's
that.
It's not propriety. It has to do with self-pride and with keeping the pride there. It's not, I'll find it later, dignity.
Thank you.
It's the word dignity. Okay, right. Because people are very dignified creatures. And I think research on all human activity has to be very careful to retain that sense of the archives are away from it, you know, sort of, I have to do, I'm trying control seekers and didn't actually get this is what sort of desperate ultimately. One has to be very, very careful with that. So in terms of collaboration and having working with someone who is working on an archive who could possibly be yourself or someone, you know, is very important. The other stuff is the other issue I want to raise is the fact that with digital imaging now we can all of us somehow make our own post-mortem little sign. Now that's, is it okay? Because a self-reference is always a self-reference. I can only talk about myself the way that I can talk myself, definitely unlike any one of you. And my view normally is extremely precious the way people see each one of us and our work. So that's another issue. The third issue is that, in a way, I mean, England is a country where digitalization is really doing very well indeed. Okay, and you can see also very well in the art that's produced, apart from anything else, but you feel the world that we all share somehow. It is very obvious. Now, in other countries where this has not evolved that much, Greece, I had to generate the interest in my sort of say, previous work or kind of work that can be digitalized in ways, in some ways. And well, if there is time, anyway, these are the main issues, but if there is time, I have a little PowerPoint available to see what I have done at some point in order to raise interest in sort of in the films, so the performance films that I used to make so many years
ago. Can I just ask there's two things to do there. I mean, in some ways, if you're your own archivist, if you're talking about having a student working with you and you have the control to produce your archive, are you talking about that as like an artwork?
Wrong. It was wrong usage of work. That was my mistake.
Because I suppose I would see an archive as being a degree of detachment. That somehow there is some objectivity that probably that we are not able to put to our own work.
You're absolutely right, but I have the material and I am the person who can offer that material. Also, each one of us, in a way, have archives which don't have to do with our own work, but they do have, but they have to do with the times that we live. For instance, Desmina says she's been collecting newspaper articles for many years. Now, this can be extremely valuable because it is seen from one particular view. With someone who simply, collects bits and pieces of newspaper, does not have a particular view. You don't have
a particular
view. I'll be quick, actually. Getting back to really your point about the politics of the politics of archive, and also time in. I'm very interested in the role of testimony and oral history in all this. And I've been working with the ING Bank for, I think, the last 6 or 7 years, who were previously Baring. And they have a most fantastic financial archive because of the Baring Bank, which was established in, 1680 or something, and also a fantastic art collection. And they've been very unwilling to allow that history to be exposed until very recently, because of the fall of the Baring Bank and the whole kind of scandal that surrounded that. And now, just very recently, for whatever reason, they've become much more confident, and so they've allowed the archive to be called the Baring Archive again. I mean, Baring until now really couldn't be mentioned. But they also commissioned an oral history of everybody from that time, to actually record that bit of history, which I think is really fascinating, actually. And it's difficult to know why, rather like when you were talking about last year and the anniversary of the abolition of slavery, I mean, that was obviously an anniversary, but it's interesting the timing that I think that surrounds the archives and why things actually happened.
Well, it was the abolition of slave trade. Slavery wasn't
exactly
abolished in the British Empire until the 20th century.
Yes, but it was interesting how museums rushed to that moment to kind of create, to tick their boxes, to kind of create some moment there. So what's interesting is, what is the residue? What's going to be the residue of this?
And there was a certain amount of cynicism,
I
really
don't think you back it.
I just wanted to say I agree with you about the idea of not controlling what people do with your archives, but certainly inputting into it, because I think artists and creatives want the limitations in what they do, and that isn't controlling, it's actually shaping it.
Mm-hmm.
To go into something with a blank sheet of paper is really daunting and a bit pointless in certain respects. And to me, as someone who applies, everyone applies to do what they're going to do, don't they? Because we're all trying to make a living from what we're doing as well. The idea of a blank sheet of A4 paper where someone says, tell us what you want to do, is the worst thing I could possibly see. I want people to actually say, this is what we're interested in, how can you interpret that? And I think archivists are curators and should be curators. And I hate the idea of things being a free-for-all where everyone can put their comment on everything and tag it and link it to things. And it ends up like Wikipedia and YouTube, and it's just rubbish. You end up with low quality, just trash. And I like the idea of, if someone doesn't want to work with your ideas, it is your archive, but at least let people work with your archive. But I think everyone should be able to discuss the situation with something, and if the artist at any point doesn't want to go the direction that you do, they stop. And if you don't want to go that direction, then you stop. It's not like you've got
no. That entails a dialogue. For as long as there is a dialogue, perfectly all right.
Yeah.
Because the whole thing is about dialogue, is it not?
Yeah, I think there's way too much random stuff going on with not just with the internet, with the way a lot of people are working with archive footage, much collage and video work I've seen with using archive footage, I think it's rubbish. And the stuff that I see projected on the walls of the South Bank, in the evening after the series events come on, that's rubbish too. And because people just randomly putting images together and putting dance music to it. And that's the thing that probably what you were showing made the lady go like that, because people don't want random images, they want more than that. We can all go and it's like in the early days of the internet when you surfed the web, you didn't really know what you were doing. You sit down and you have whatever the early, I can't remember what the early search engines were, but you'd sit there and go, well, what should I look for? And it's just like this big random thing, and it's like running around and just throwing books everywhere, that's what it's written of, and you get no knowledge, and you end up feeling empty and confused, and it's completely overloaded. So I believe in curation and direction, and also, I'm not into open access to the point of that there's no curation, it's just chaos. And I think that people should guide archives. And
it's interesting, though, because we've got this whole range between selection and exclusion. Both those trends have come out, there's certain things being excluded from archives, and then at the same time in the digital environment it kind of opens up that absolutely everything's been, so it goes almost to the other degree. And I think it's finding a comfortable path that is inclusive enough, but doesn't some kind of
one tiny point from Kathy, and then I'm actually going to turn it into an informal discussion later on.
I just want to say back to Vicky really that surely all archives by their nature are random.
Yes.
I mean, what's in them, how they got there, I mean, it's so random.
But then can you steer them in the direction of their personal interests?
Yes, and I suppose it takes us a full circle back around to where we started.
Well, where
it
might,
is it,
where
and
it
what
might,
their personal interest is.
Yeah, where it might take us, actually, I think we are going to have to really stop, because we'll stop people dealing with the editing if we're going to an informal lunch, and we'll see. Two things. One, one thing is that maybe where it takes us back is to methodology. Because the methodology that's emerged for me over the last couple of days is negotiation, collaboration, and so on. And those are actual methodologies that we also, and tactics and strategic methodologies that come out a lot of our practice in a way. So the way that addresses that, collage being one of those kind of methodologies too, in a sense, isn't it? And could we then go away and talk about this informally? And at three, if anyone is interested, either let me say thank you for this discussion and thank you to Vicky and Sue and Steve and to everybody this morning. But if you're interested, at 3 o'clock we'll have a small plenary with a cup of tea, maybe some round a number of tables saying, okay, well, out of all these ideas, where might we think of some really practical kinds of forms of collaboration and negotiation, if you like? Because otherwise we're going to kind of carry on, and I think we need to, well, before we pass out, so let's have some lunch and go to the cordial. So thank you all very, very much.
But I'm saying,
get some, you know, people to talk about these problems.
Well, they didn't do that anyway. I felt like they should sit with my finger on my lip, my hand on my head, after that, I felt like I could see as it's spoken.
Yeah. No, I should have made it more clear to begin with that, no, I'm not creating a piece of work here.
No,
I'm talking about ways that one might interrogate.
As a research person, I'm quite interested in it, and I'm going to show you three examples of something that I think that was imminent.
You know what it's like when you're so kind of like, you know, I'm so into it myself that sometimes you forget to mention the obvious. Which is, yeah.
And also, I think you're actually looking at it through here, and I don't know, maybe there's something about seeing these in both, because it was different, because it's rare, and it's just.
Well, this is the white screen.
Yeah.
Which I know is just changes kind of the.
No, but I was saying, once you're not looking at it on a computer screen, I have a relation to the image.
Right, yeah, this is more intimate. This is more public.
That was also why I
just thought, I think you used the simplest form